continue to stand by for today's conference. Conference will begin momentarily. Again, thank you for your patience. Please continue to stand by for today's conference. Welcome and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question and answer session, please press star 1 and record your name as prompted. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn today's meeting over to Sandy Walsh. Thank you. You may begin. And we're not hearing anything at this time.
Carolyn? This is FDA in the room. Are you there?
Yes. I'm not hearing anything.
We're ready to begin the call, Carolyn. Are we joined in?
Thank you. Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I apologize. Let me begin again. I do apologize. Welcome and thank you for standing by. All participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question and answer session, please press star 1 and record your name as prompted. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn today's meeting over to Sandy Walsh. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Sandy Walsh from the FDA's Office of Media Affairs. Thank you for joining us for today's media briefing regarding the issuance of the proposed rule on sunscreens. By now, our press release has been issued and notification has been posted in the Federal Register. Today, I'm joined by FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb, who will provide remarks on the announcement. I'm also joined by Dr. Teresa Michel, Director of the Division of Non-Prescription Drug Products in the FDA Center for Drug Evaluation and Research, who will then provide details about the proposed rule. After their remarks, we will then move to the question and answer portion of the call. Reporters will be in a listen-only mode until we open up the call for questions. With that, I will now turn it over to Dr. Gottlieb.
Thanks a lot, and I want to thank everyone for taking the time to join us this morning. I'm very pleased to update you on today's important sunscreen policy advances. The comprehensive proposed rule that we issued today would update regulatory requirements for most sunscreen products in the United States to better ensure consumers have access to safe and effective preventative sun care options in line with the latest science. This action is an important step in the FDA's efforts to take into account modern science to ensure the safety and effectiveness of sunscreens, and we see it as a major health policy priority, and our regulatory obligation is to make sure that products marketed to offer protection from the sun's effects deliver those promises to consumers. Broad-spectrum sunscreens with SPF values of at least 15 are critical tools that we have for preventing skin cancer and protecting the skin from damage caused by the sun's rays. Yet some of the essential requirements for these preventative tools haven't been updated in literally decades. Since the initial evaluation of these products, we know much more about the effects of the sun and about sunscreen's absorption through the skin. Sunscreen usage has changed also. Consumer habits with respect to how they use sunscreens has changed, with more people using these products more frequently and in larger amounts. At the same time, sunscreen formulations have evolved as companies have innovated. The proposed rule we've put forward today has the potential to improve the quality, the safety, and the efficacy of sunscreens Americans use every day. It's the culmination of a lot of thoughtful efforts and hard work over many years by a number of FDA staff that have carefully considered this important topic and the science available to inform our thinking. And as we work to finalize this rule, we'll continue to work with the industry and the public health stakeholders and consumer groups to make sure that we're striking the right balance among all the considerations. Among the provisions the proposal addresses today are sunscreen active ingredient safety, dosage forms, sun protection factor, or SPF, and broad spectrum requirements. It also proposes updates to how products are labeled to make it easier for consumers to identify key product information as they shop for sunscreen in the stores. It's important for me to note that as this rulemaking effort moves forward and as the FDA gathers additional scientific information, given the recognized public health benefits of sunscreen use, consumers should continue to use broad-spectrum sunscreen with SPF values of at least 15 in conjunction with other sun protection measures. Notably, to help make sure this effort is successful, the FDA is looking to industry to gather the data that we believe is needed to help ensure that products marketed to offer protection from the sun's effects are safe and deliver on these promises to consumers. And through this rulemaking process, we're seeking to balance needed product innovation with ensuring that consumers are properly protected from the sun's harmful effects based on the latest scientific evidence on these products. I want to just close by thanking once again all the stakeholders who provided critical input to this rulemaking process, including consumer groups, industry partners, a lot of scientific experts who have helped inform our work. And I want to just close finally by thanking the men and women of the Center for Drugs here at FDA. This rulemaking has been underway for quite some time, and a lot of effort has gone into this. People have been committed to this over many years, and so this is the culmination of a really extensive effort on the part of the agency, and I just want to thank them for their commitment to this. And so now I'll turn it over to Terry to discuss the specific provisions of the proposed rules, and she's one of those experts who has been working on this for a very long time. We're very grateful for her efforts. Terry, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Gottlieb. So I'd like to start off with just some background. This proposed rule applies only to sunscreen active ingredients currently on the market in the United States without FDA-approved applications, and that's actually the vast majority of sunscreens available in the United States. They're marketed under a regulatory framework called the OTC or over-the-counter monograph system. OTC monographs establish conditions under which the FDA permits certain over-the-counter drugs to be marketed without approved new drug applications because they are generally recognized as safe and effective, or what we call GRACE, and not misbranded. So more specifically, we're issuing this proposed rule as part of the regulatory process of putting into effect a final monograph regulations for over-the-counter sunscreen drug products as required by the Sunscreen Innovation Act. So to establish a final monograph for sunscreens, the FDA is reviewing the active ingredients in these products to determine whether the ingredients are GRACE for OTC sunscreen use, and it's also about evaluating various other conditions for use of these ingredients. So now I'm going to provide you with a brief overview of the main provisions in the proposed rule. So first, we've proposed that of the 16 currently marketed active ingredients, two ingredients, zinc oxide and titanium dioxide, are GRACE for use in sunscreens. Two ingredients, PABA and trolamine salicylate, are not GRACE for use in sunscreens due to safety issues. These two ingredients do not currently appear on the U.S. market in sunscreens. There are 12 ingredients for which we propose there are insufficient safety data to make a positive GRACE determination at this time. So to address these 12 ingredients, we're asking industry and other interested parties for additional data. We are working closely with industry, and we've published several guidances to further explain certain tests and make sure companies understand what data the FDA believes it needs to evaluate safety and effectiveness for sunscreen active ingredients, including the 12 ingredients for which we're seeking more data in this rulemaking. I want to emphasize that this request for additional data does not mean that FDA has concluded that these 12 ingredients are unsafe. Rather, we're requesting additional information on these ingredients so we can evaluate their GRACE status in light of changed conditions, including substantially increased sunscreen use. So while these additional data are being gathered, we recommend that consumers continue to use broad-spectrum sunscreen of SPF 15 or higher in conjunction with other sun protective measures to reduce the risk of sunburn, skin cancer, and early skin aging caused by the sun. Next, we propose that dosage forms that are graced for use as sunscreens include sprays, oils, lotions, creams, gels, butters, pastes, ointments, and sticks. Powders are proposed to be eligible for inclusion in the monograph, but we believe that additional data are needed before powders can be included. Wipes, towelettes, body washes, shampoos, and other dosage forms are proposed to be categorized as new drugs requiring pre-market approval because the FDA has not received data showing that they are eligible for inclusion in the monograph. Moving on to SPF, we propose to raise the maximum SPF value on sunscreen labels from a previous proposal of SPF 50 plus to SPF 60 plus because evidence shows clinical benefit of broad spectrum SPF 60 plus sunscreens. We've also proposed to require sunscreens with an SPF value of 15 or higher to provide broad-spectrum protection, that for broad-spectrum products, as SPF increases, the magnitude of protection against ultraviolet A radiation also increases. To address concerns raised by recent evidence further linking UVA radiation to skin cancer and other harms, these proposals are designed to ensure that sunscreens provide consumers with the protections that they expect. We've also proposed new sunscreen product label requirements to assist consumers in more easily identifying key information, including the addition of active ingredients on the front of the package to bring sunscreen in line with other over-the-counter drugs that have this information, including a notification on the label for consumers to read the skin cancer and skin aging alert for sunscreens that have not been shown to help prevent skin cancer. And we're also proposing revised formats for SPF, broad spectrum, and water-resistant statements. We propose to clarify FDA's expectations for testing and make sure that record-keeping by entities that conduct sunscreen testing to ensure that FDA can assess industry compliance with regulation. And finally, we propose that products that combine sunscreens with insect repellents are not GRACE. We're seeking public comment on this proposed rule, and we'll carefully consider the comments that are submitted as we work towards developing a final rule. We've issued guidance to industry on how FDA intends to enforce sunscreen regulations in the interim while we work towards a final rule. So in closing, I just want to echo Dr. Gottlieb's comments about sun safety. As this rulemaking process proceeds, consumers should continue to use broad-spectrum sunscreen of SPF 15 or higher, along with other sun protective measures to reduce the risk of skin cancer and early skin aging caused by the sun. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Sandy Walsh.
Thank you, Dr. Gottlieb and Dr. Michelle. Operator, we're ready to begin our question and answer portion. When asking a question, please state your name and affiliation. Also, please limit yourself to one question and one follow-up so we can get to as many questions as possible. Operator, we'll take the first question.
Thank you. And again, as a reminder, for a question or a comment, it is star one. Make sure your phone is unmuted and record your name. And our first question or comment comes from Ryan Nelson from HBW Insight. Your line is open.
Hey, guys. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thanks for taking questions. I'm just curious, you know, about the timeline here. And I know you just mentioned that that you included some guidance to industry about enforcement in the interim while you're working toward a final rule. And I'm sorry, I haven't gotten to that point in the actual proposed rule yet. But I'm just curious. I mean, this came out today. You're going to be collecting and going through what will probably be a huge number of comments. And then under the Sunscreen Innovation Act anyway, the final rule is due in November, I believe. I'm just curious as to sort of what kind of enforcement discretion will be used going forward beyond November or beyond the final rule, or just, you know, how do you expect there not to be a pretty significant market disruption as a result of this these changes in the data you're seeking for ingredients?
Right. So I believe that your concern, if I might paraphrase, is that it may take industry longer to come up with some of the data that we're asking for than the 90-day comment period. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I would expect seeing how the time and extent applications have gone sort of for new next generation kind of UV filters, I mean, it seems like some of the bioavailability data and so forth, it seems to be, FDA seems to be looking for existing ingredients, takes a long time to generate. So we're just thinking, you know, longer term than even this year, you know, what will happen with sort of the sunscreen market if suddenly, you know, we have over a dozen ingredients or whatever it is that are insufficient data currently.
Right. So we're very aware of that, and we're committed to working with industry and other public health stakeholders to help ensure that these sunscreens that are so critical are safe and effective and are out there on the market for consumers. So we'll consider requests to defer further rulemaking with respect to a specific sunscreen active ingredient to allow for the submission of new safety or effectiveness data to the record if such requests are submitted to the docket within the initial 90-day comment period. So we'll review all of the data and information submitted to the record in conjunction with all timely and complete requests to extend.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Operator, next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question or comment comes from Kathleen Doney from WebMD. Your line is open.
Thank you. Two quick questions. What do you see as the most significant part of this proposed rule? And at this point, should consumers avoid certain ingredients in sunscreens or not?
So I'm going to take the second question first, and then I'll address the first question. So the second question you asked, should consumers avoid certain ingredients? And the answer to that is absolutely not. The two ingredients that we are proposing to be not generally recognized as safe and effective are actually not in any marketed sunscreens that we're aware of. The ingredients that we're proposing we need more data on, we're not saying that they're unsafe at this time, and we are, in fact, encouraging consumers to continue to use sunscreens SPF 15 or higher in broad spectrum. So the first question that you asked is, what do we think the most significant part of this rulemaking is? And there are a lot of exciting parts of this rule that are designed to do one thing, to make sure that consumers have the best possible products available. I think one of the key parts of the rule is actually the additional broad spectrum requirements that are in there that we're proposing. Because right now, as the SPF goes up, it's not absolute that the broad spectrum coverage and the UVA coverage goes up proportionally. But the testing that we are proposing as part of this rulemaking would ensure that that happens, so that when consumers believe that they are getting a more protective product against skin cancer and early skin aging, they actually are.
And that's due partly to some of the new findings, recent findings about UVA?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Operator, we'll take the next question.
Thank you. Our next question or comment comes from Eileen Francis, and please state your affiliation.
Hi. Yes, I'm Eileen Francis with the Pink Sheet. I was just wondering how the new rules for labeling SPS would result in less exposure to sunscreen products labeled with potentially misleading sun protection information.
Right. So the SPFs right now go all the way up as high as sponsors wish to include on their label. We had previously proposed that SPF labeling be limited to 50-plus. We've now extended that to 60-plus because as part of the 2011 proposed rule, we got additional data showing benefit of the higher SPF sunscreens. So we are proposing that sunscreens would not be labeled with an SPF higher than 60-plus because it's not clear that there's a benefit to consumers above that level.
Okay.
Thank you. Operator, we'll take the next question.
Thank you. Our next question or comment comes from Andrew Siddons from Congressional Quarterly. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks for doing this today. So could you just give me a sense of, like, how many products are on the market now that are not using the ingredients that are the two ingredients that are generally recognized as safe, and will the products that use those other 12 ingredients, will there be a point when they would have to come off the market at some point?
So to our knowledge, there are no sunscreens currently on the market that contain the two active ingredients that we are proposing to be not generally recognized as safe. There are many sunscreens on the market using the 12 ingredients that we're requesting additional data on. We do expect that industry will come in with additional data, and so we'll just have to wait and see to determine where the safety data are for these ingredients going forward.
But you would have to take it on, like, a case-by-case basis to see if something needed to, like, come off the market while it's pending a review, or...
Nothing is coming off the market currently under the proposed rule. That would be only based on a final rule after we had gotten all the data.
So sorry if I'm just confusing things more, but under the obviously you still have to finalize this rule, but once you finalize it, then that's presumably when the evidence generation would have to begin for these other 12 ingredients. All I'm trying to get a sense of is if, you know, those would be subject to some sort of, like, grace period while they're still on sale while you're undergoing a review, or, you know, would they, you know, have to hold off on sales while you're reviewing them once
right.
the rule is finalized?
So let me explain a little bit. The way the rulemaking process works, this proposed rule is asking for the additional data. And if industry or other stakeholders need additional time to submit those data, they can request during the comment period to have an extension to deliver that data, and they would have to provide information ensuring that they will be delivering the data that are requested. At that point in time, we may offer a referral for that particular ingredient from the final rule. The final rule will include all of the ingredients for which we have not gotten deferral requests that we have granted.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Andrew, did that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so.
I just want to make sure you're clear on it.
Right. Because I guess normally in a rulemaking, you would think that it's only the final rule, you know, kind of has the force of things. But it sounds like under this one, the proposed people will actually have to submit things to FDA based on what's in the proposed rule. And
yeah,
not,
that's actually
not just
how
what's
it
in the final
always
rule.
Works. Usually the proposed rule asks for information, and the final rule conveys our findings based on the information that was submitted under the proposal.
Okay, but in this case, like I think when I'm normally covering a rulemaking, the request for the proposed rule is subject to, you know, public comments. But in this case, the comments will kind of come in the form of the data you're asking them to submit for some of these ingredients.
And request for additional time to generate that data, because the rulemaking and the guidance lays out the parameters for how they're going to go about generating that information to be included in the final rule, if I'm articulating it correctly. I hope Terry could correct me.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's helpful. Thank you.
And our goal here, just to sort of accentuate the point, the goal here is to get the data and you know, validate the effectiveness and the safety of all of these ingredients, and so that's the process we're working towards here.
Great, thank you, Dr. Gottlieb. We'll take the next question, please.
Thank you. And again, as a reminder, for a question or comment from the phones, please press *1. Make sure your phone is unmuted and record your name. And our next question or comment comes from Matt Perrone from Associated Press. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you, guys. I'm just trying to understand the kind of regulatory timeline. Can you talk a little bit about how this differs or complements or supersedes the 2011 rules we got on sunscreen? Does this replace them, or is this a totally separate process you're going through?
So the 2011 rules covered a variety of aspects of sunscreen. This particular rulemaking covers pretty much everything related to sunscreens. And in the 2011 rules remain in effect, the ones that were finalized. For dosage forms, that rulemaking was only a proposal. Actually, it was an ANPR.
And is this the first time, or not the first time, but you're looking at the grass, the new ingredients, versus that wasn't part of the 2011 process?
So the ingredients that we're looking at actually aren't new ingredients. They were on the market at the time of the inception of the monograph in the early 70s, and FDA looked at them initially, but that particular sunscreen monograph has never had a final monograph that was in effect. So we are, with this, taking an important step in finalizing that sunscreen monograph as required by the Sunscreen Innovation Act.
I see. So this is the monograph process, and what happened in 2011 was?
So what happened in 2011 were important steps that were a portion of the monograph. So they just addressed SPF. They just addressed dosage forms. This addresses the entire thing.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Matt. Operator, we have time for one more question.
Thank you. And our final question or comment comes from Ryan Nelson from HBW Insight. Your line is open.
Sorry, I didn't jump back in the queue, but I appreciate you taking the question. I'm just wondering if you can offer some more detail. I mean, somebody asked about the SPF labeling before. I think what we're more interested in, there's new process, I guess, for labeling SPFs on products based on the testing that was in the 2011 final rule, that testing process. So I think it seems like now there's manufacturers will have to be labeling a range of SPFs on products, or maybe taking the lowest value of the SPF results they get. I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit more about that, because we definitely did see, like, you know, lawsuits against companies for alleged fraud in terms of SPF. And it seems like FDA is trying to address that to some extent with this proposed rule. So I was hoping you could provide some color on that.
Right. So let me talk a little bit about that. One of the difficulties with, an SPF value is that it isn't a laboratory test. SPF is actually measured via clinical testing by looking at erythema on or redness of the skin after exposure to a light source. And as you might imagine, there's a fair amount of variability in that. And as the SPF goes higher, the variability gets greater. So what we're proposing is a range of SPF that will, number one, make it easier for consumers because there's a clear difference between an SPF of 15 and an SPF of 30. In addition, in order to make it clearer, we are asking manufacturers to label the lowest number in the range. So that should, we think, decrease some of the variability because there's actually pretty much no difference between an SPF of 29 and an SPF of 30. And that's where the ranges come from.
Okay. And on a related note, could you just say, I know that you're capping or proposing an SPF 60 plus cap. And then you note that you could still, though, have on the market a product that is an SPF of as much as 80, but not higher than 80. And that was confusing to me. So that means that if you test your product and it tests as higher than SPF 80, that would need a new drug application?
That's correct.
So either way, though, you could only label it SPF 60 plus, but you could have something that's more effective than that on the market until it gets to SPF 80. And what is the reasoning there?
Well, not necessarily more effective. So let me see if I can explain that. So we believe that there are no data to support benefit above an SPF of 60 in terms of measuring of the SPF. However, when you create a sunscreen formulation, you're trying to do two things. You are trying to protect against UVB, and you're also trying to protect against UVA. So the sunscreens contain a variety of different ingredients in order to provide coverage across that whole spectrum. The SPF really only measures the protection against UVB. The UVA protection doesn't show up as a number on the label. It shows up as the term broad spectrum. And we've put in some new requirements to ensure that as SPF goes up, the broad spectrum protection also goes up. So we've allowed a little bit of wiggle for manufacturers who are manufacturing a high SPF product to allow that they may need to include additional ingredients to get that broad spectrum or UVA coverage. So that's the cap. However, we believe that adding a whole lot of additional ingredients to technically push up that number doesn't do anything, and therefore consumers would be getting the negative effects of having more ingredients in their sunscreen without any efficacy benefits to balance it out. That's why there's a formulation cap of 80.
Interesting. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Operator, we will conclude the call now. This concludes today's media briefing on the sunscreen proposed rule. A replay will be available in about an hour and will be available for 30 days. Please remember to check the FDA newsroom on our website for the press release, which links to all the important materials. Thank you, everyone.
That concludes today's conference call. Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at this time.